You're the million-dollar question, Lance. I've got to ask you, do you think there's a question that we need to be asking ourselves and others that we're just not doing at the moment?
Why? Like, literally, why? The question is why? In essence, I think people are getting put into positions where they have to really think deeply about why they do what they do. Are they doing it for clicks? Are they doing it to impress everyone but themselves, right? Where they have a sense of pride. And that, to me, goes all the way back to why. Like, why? Why are you in the job that you are? Why did you pick the partner that you did if you chose to cohabitate or be a parent or live where you live? Like, why? And I think it's a one-word question. But I think it's the kind, here's the funny thing, ASG. Think about, when I think about like the graduate students I used to work with at Vanderbilt or any of these college students, you know, what's their, one of their big concerns? One of their big concerns is, okay, they graduate and they start applying for jobs. Okay. They get an interview and they go to the hiring manager for that interview. What are they going to be asked? They're basically going to be asked why. Why did you choose this path? Why us? Right. And it's, those are the questions where I don't care. It doesn't even matter age, right? It's like, oh God, how do I answer this? I don't know. I need a job but they're getting at the essence of like, well, are you going to be here for the long haul? Or do you see this as a stepping stone? Like, we want to know if we're investing our money in you, that you're going to be investing your time and skill and talent in growing in us, right? Or in relationships. And so to me, it literally goes back to why. Like, that's the question that we're not answering. And I have countless examples. I don't want to bore your audience, but God knows, being a middle-aged man with kids who play sports, and you go and things are going on all around the world, and there'll be really nice people that I like, parents, there'll be some catastrophe and they'll go, and I'll say, gosh, can you believe that, you know, that earthquake in Eastern Russia and the tsunami warning that was just a massive warning around the world, you know, just thinking about how fragile we are. And they'll go, I had no idea. It's like, okay, I'm not saying you have to have an opinion about it, but like, why are you so anti sort of information or learning about other folks or being a learning junkie? So that's a very long answer to a one-word question. Do you like that? Hopefully that's the longest response and shortest question you've ever been provided, ASG. If I've done that, I've won the gold.
You definitely won gold. But I had to tell you my reasoning for it, because I put the story out in my newsletter, but I never knew that this would resonate with people, because it's just always been with me. But someone asked me recently the same question that I asked you. My answer was, who are you? Because like I ask always at the beginning of the episode, who is? And a lot of people, the reason why I don't really know, the reason why I ask that is, I get asked it once in an interview for a job. Someone asked me, who am I? And I read off just what was on my CV or whatever. And halfway through, he went, who are you? And I said it in fancier terms. And then he stopped me again and he put his notes on the table and he went, who are you? And I genuinely couldn't. I threw me out of the room about 2 minutes later because I didn't have an answer for him. But I noticed it then when I'm out in like social situations. There was a guy that had a little bit too much to drink, but there was a guy who came over to the table and this guy just looked at him and goes, who are you? And he just it couldn't answer it. Even when he was under the influence of alcohol, still couldn't answer it. And I just thought that the way that you answered it was perfect, because those direct questions, the basic questions that you would write to a toddler, or how to make conversation with someone, a lot of people can't answer them.
They can't answer them. You're exactly right. You're dead on with that. That is, to me, I love that, who are you? Because you're right. People can't answer that, right? Look, you're afraid in marriages as they go through decades being together. It's like, okay, well, who are you now that we're 20 years in or 30 years in, right? Because there's always the fear of, gosh, what if I answer and it doesn't sound like we should be together, right? Or, you know, who are you relative to your career? God, what if I don't enjoy it anymore? it's that Pandora's box that everybody's running from. Pandora's box is like tethered to all of us.
I've got a two-part question now. So the first part of the question is, would you consider yourself successful?
My initial reaction to that question is, check back with me later. Like, I think of life as a continuum. I don't think of it as I'm a guy who didn't go to college graduation, graduate school graduation. Like, I didn't go to these things because I had stuff to do. But I would also say, like, you know, that's actually a flaw of me, that I struggle to celebrate things. And some of that may come from or be born from that anxiety that was put into me with the best of intentions from my father. Like, you can never, like, let up. You got to always educate yourself so that you don't find yourself on the chopping block. So I don't know. But on the other side, the other side of the coin, not that you asked it in this way, but I think to myself, I do need to somehow acknowledge whatever I have achieved, at least to other people's standards, so that hope, if I can inspire a young person to be curious, doesn't mean they have to be a journalist or a reporter or a podcaster or a writer. It just means that they're curious and they want to understand whatever creativity they have that's unique to them. Because this is, to me, about creativity and the power of spontaneity. That creates connections. The irony is this stuff happens to us all the time, right? People are dating, they're younger, whatever, they're hanging out, they go to some event or a poetry reading or a bar or a conference, and they randomly turn the corner and they meet somebody. And that turns out to be a 30-year marriage and going, right? And all these sorts of things. So I'd like to think that I've been successful to a point where it has inspired people to at least want to know other folks. And I will lastly say to that, yeah, I want the book to do well, but not for the reasons that many people might think. I want it to do well so that it provides me the opportunity to platform other people's stories who otherwise wouldn't have the opportunity. And if the book does well, that just means that another publisher or the same publisher goes, hey, what do you want to do next? You know what? I brought this up the other day, and then I thought, that's not a bad idea. Like, I wouldn't mind capturing stories that are of people that are classified as, that are in hospice, that are terminally ill. Just understand them, because I think there's so much that we can learn from people in ways where we can honor them with dignity and learn from them for all generations. So that's a very long-winded response to your first question.
I had to ask you because I think on paper you are the definition of it, but everybody's got their own definition. It's in the eye of the beholder. But it sets up the second part, which is how did you bounce back to this level of success after your first classroom tech startup failed?
You know, there used to be professions where you were told no, or you were, you know, it wasn't going to happen unless there was some lucky strike of, you know, lightning that hit and randomly a movie producer said, we're looking for a guy, you know, that looks like, oh, ASG, you're the one. And all of a sudden you're in the movies, right? And so there are more and more opportunities now for people to try everything from becoming a singer to being an entrepreneur to whatever it is that you want to do. And so building up that tolerance around defeat and whatever defeat means and or how optimistic we are. So I've been a part of a lot of different sort of starts and stops is what I would say. And I've been through the experience of losing a company and through, you know, very incredible means in that regard and what happened. The bounce back for me is understanding my own larger story, which, please, I want to make sure people hear me correctly in this way. It's not about something that's self-serving or like my ego in that regard. What I don't want to do and I guard against, it's like there's a kid's book, and I may get this wrong, and I wrote about it actually in my book, but it's about this dad who's taking his kids on a bear hunt, and it's like you can't go through it. You can't go over it. You can't go under it. You got to get through it or something like that. Right. It's just sort of this like for like toddlers, right? Like how to get through something. And for me going through those experiences, one thing I told myself, as hard as this is, as hard as it is to walk into a courtroom setting and deal with financial ruin and all these crazy things, and provide story that relates and speaks for me, I have to let all those feelings in. Like I have to, like, why in the world did I do all my training in mental health and everything to now basically not practice what I was, you know, taught and what I asked of others, right? So the bounce back for me was really embedded in, man, I got to feel this. I said, yes, I had the best of intentions. I believed people, right? I worked my tail off. And it didn't work out. What did I learn about myself, and how in the world can I weave this into stories that hopefully will resonate with other people? And my validation for that ASG was when I was, there was a point in time when I was afraid to share that, even with people that knew me, right? Like, wow, I didn't know you were going through all that. I finally, there was one conversation I had with someone, and it came up only because they had had the vulnerability to share with me, sort of off record, what they had been going through. And I had no clue. What they'd been going through was very similar to what I was going through. And he was in a different country too. He wasn't in the US, so he was in a European country. And that just said to me, you know what, sort of get off the couch here and be okay in sharing, because I've started finding, wow, a lot of people may not have the exact story, but they've got one that's very similar. And all it did was make me feel more human, and it conveyed a level of humanity to other people where then I built stronger and better connections and relationships.
You put a lot of emphasis on storytelling and the power of learning through it. What's a story you've heard in your interviews that just blew your mind that you really didn't expect from the person who said it?
Oh gosh, how long is your show? Sammy Hagar of Van Halen is one that absolutely stands out, because yeah, people know him. He's obviously a music icon, but he talked about growing up so poor. His family, they were lettuce farmers. And the story of his grandfather in the double wide trailer, and how the grandfather, despite not having means, loved to cook, and he made Italian food, and he did it in a way where you felt like you were walking into like an Italian cafe. Like, he just took such pride in the way in which he cooked that young Sammy would be walking down the trail to his grandfather's double wide trailer, and the smell would tell him that his grandfather was cooking something. Like, I revel in that stuff, because that's like, people say like, oh, that's gold, you know, gold Jerry from Seinfeld or something. those are the things that matter to me. Right. I mean, that's the first one that jumps to mind, but then there are the stories that I didn't capture. And those are the ones that probably sit closer to my consciousness than any, the people that I wanted to spend more time with and didn't get the opportunity for whatever reason. Those are the ones that stick with me.
Do these people that you interview, the people that we would say are quote unquote more powerful than others, when they're telling stories, are they any different to the people that you meet in refugee camps or whenever you're in these like UN meetings and stuff like that? Or is the core narrative and concepts all the exact same?
I don't know if they're the exact same. I think the way in which we get to whatever that endpoint is might be a little bit different. Right. So you get some officials, and you're going to meander down political speak or sort of talking points, or they're going to stay close to the vest. Right. And so you just know there's a bit of a lag time before you can get to sort of the essence of who they are and why in the world do they hold that post. Sort of juxtaposition, you know, you're talking to a refugee who they may be more raw in what they're sharing just because their reality never lets up. They don't have an opportunity to take a shower, change clothes, and go out to dinner and just sort of reset after a long day, right? They're where they are, and it's not changing for them. So I think very similar sort of in the destination maybe that I'm trying to get to without an objective. I don't ever say like, man, I'm hoping I'm going to get this out of that person. I never say that. But the way in which we meander along that to a point where they're sharing stuff about, let's say, family or their upbringing. Like, I love to ask a question about sort of take me inside the kitchen, you know, sit me down at the kitchen table when you were a kid, right? And I'll get stuff like, it was so silent, you know? The hum of the refrigerator is all you heard, you know, to the opposite, which was we were debating like cats and dogs just fighting, but we knew we weren't fighting. Right. And so, oh, wow, that may mean why you're in the position you're in now. Like, you're not afraid of conflict. So the challenge in the person that, let's say, is as polished or has resource, maybe is a better way to put it. The challenge is trying to break that mold that they're just used to when it comes to if they think you're a reporter. Look, I think journalism is dead in a lot of ways, and I don't even like the term journalist, because to me they're going out, they've got an objective. They've got to get a certain set of, you know, information. They're looking at word counts. It's like, no, if you're capturing a story, I don't know where it's going to all go and how we get there. But that plays a huge role. And I just look at this. See, I just lost my train of thought. You got me. I was thinking about the refugee camp and I just careened off the side there, ASG. So bring me back into the lane, if you don't mind.
Well, I actually have a piggyback question now, because you've sparked a train of curiosity in my mind now as well, because today I was listening to a few of like your interviews with people, and those, like, I always feel like those people that they seem to come from those like real hardship backgrounds, you know, like the people that come from like poverty or like definitely trauma, or even like some of the people you've interviewed, they're like born into like pretty much war zones. Have you noticed anything that those people have in common, the ones that come out the other side much stronger?
As you were saying that, there was a woman, and forgive me for not being able to remember her exact name right now, but I interviewed her. She wrote a book about three young girls and over three summers in a war zone. And she shared a story with me in our interview about how she was in the kitchen and they could see their backyard was, there was a river that meandered through the community. And the father could see that soldiers were just on the other side. And he said to his daughter, which I can't fathom as a father and a father of a daughter, he said, "I'm sorry, they're gonna be here any moment. They're probably gonna take you, assault you, and kill me." And that was so vivid for me in her words, right? It doesn't mean that her story has, in essence, more weight, which would equate to some level of value above somebody else's story of whatever that's benign. I mean, it's pretty hard to come up against someone who thinks they have impending death or assault, as opposed to someone who's just talking about an exit from a startup or something. But yeah, there is, you know what it is too? There's value in the silence, ASG. Like, you'll find that if the topic is heavier, or you're hitting on something that is, it's pretty deep, or there's a cliff there where you're getting close to and you got to be careful, just out of respect and deference for them, that silence is as valuable in that interview as the words that are spoken.
I always hear this thing people say, and it's really stupid. It happens a lot now, but I'll use the example of a story you just said. Like, people that would speak to someone like her would struggle to relate to her story. So they would think, right, we have nothing in common, no point in me speaking to her. But if you're there to interview her, how do you find common ground and even your own mind so that you can ask better, like, deeper questions into that topic? Because that's a heavy blow of the story, like you mentioned.
It's in the pursuit of humanity. And what I mean by that is, like, and I didn't know this early on. I don't know if I did this early on and I couldn't recognize it, but I'm okay with appearing to you genuinely as I'm fumbling to find my own way or words to convey that I've never been in your situation. I don't know what that is like, but I'm trying to understand it so that I can connect with you from a human level, right? For those out there that struggle in silence, that kind of a thing. So one sort of, I guess maybe not in your face example, but like more of a overt example would be, and I made this decision, your audience might think I'm crazy, but my first trip to the continent, Africa, for whatever, I had this experience where I was in the bush, and I had this experience where I know, like, I met these kids, right? They had never seen a white face before. And I cannot tell you, someone says, like, on, you know, in your deathbed and whatever, what are you going to think about? That, not that you'd put that on your bucket list at all, but it's like, man, I cashed in some lotto ticket I didn't know that I had access to, because I cannot tell you, people talk about like the birth of their kids or getting married or like these pivotal sort of life, I guess, events. To have someone look at you and see, you are the first face that they've seen that looks like you. I don't know how you put words into that. I've never figured out how to put words to that. And so after that experience, for whatever reason, I was spurred on. I got curious as to, like, what do they call someone with a white face where that's not something that you see? And so everywhere I go in Africa, I ask that. I want to know. And then you know what I do, which, trust me, people, like, other Caucasians have been like, why would you do that? Like, they're nervous or something. I use it. I absolutely use it. A year ago, I was in Tanzania, and I was in a very remote, like incredibly remote hillside where like the little kids that I saw, you know, just learning how to walk will probably never leave that hillside, even to go to a small town, that kind of remote. And I'm interviewing a grandmother who would walk almost 6 hours a day just to get clean water for grandkids who could, so they could go to school. And even through a translator, when I would say just a Mzungu, like, you know, like being affable in a way that says, I don't have the answers. And I'm totally aware of what I potentially represent. And it's like the wall drops completely and you have this amazing connection with people. So that is a, I'm not saying everyone should try that. You got to be comfortable in your own skin, but I'm completely comfortable in saying to people, I don't know, I have no clue, but I really want to know how to better understand. And I think that that served me well. And I think it's also in the nonverbals, like the listening. We could talk about what annoys us in the beginning. Like, man, people don't listen, ASG. They don't listen. Sometimes it's like, just like literally zip it and just act like you're listening and watch the response. People will say, man, you're so much fun to talk to. In your head, you're like, I haven't said a word, but I'm so glad you enjoyed it, right? So I think that that plays a huge role. At least that's my attempt. And I hope that in the attempt, it conveys something where people will give me a little bit more runway. All right, let's see where this goofball's going. Like, okay, he's at least not coming. He's not trying to be that guy. I don't want to be that guy.
You've named yourself a learning junkie, which I'm so annoyed I didn't come up with that term myself. But how do you think that with that obsession you have with learning, you become more curious, which maybe drives this saying yes to everything?
The, you know, the essence of being a learning junkie, it's that how lucky am I? Who cares what the result is, if it's an article or some like a podcast or a TV piece or whatever. I got time to spend with somebody and learn from them in a way where they had to shut everything else out, they couldn't answer emails or their phone, and I got undivided attention from somebody about their world and how they perceive it, right? Are you, this is like masterclass on like drugs or something. How fortunate am I? And what happens, I'm so glad you brought this up, is it creates this, it's a bit of an addiction in that regard. I don't mean it from, it impacts me functionally or in my life, but you do. It's like returning a car at an airport, a rental car. When you cross over those spikes, you can't back up. I can't back up because you know what? It's like when someone says, well, do you think there's a story there? Like that to me is one of the silly, I should have said that as my, like what annoys me when someone says, well, is there really a story? How the hell is there not a story? Like that should be at minimum. Someone who wants to do what I do, whatever the heck you want to call it in the storytelling world, you should be able to be interested in just about anybody and everything. And you should be really curious about the angle because that's the learning junkie component, right? It's like, oh, wow. And you know what? It is absolutely exciting when you go, there's the angle. That like in the moment I'm having the conversation or it's the moment before the interview starts or when I get off the plane or what, oh my gosh, I can't believe I found that angle. And I had that, I'll tell you, when it annoyed me to myself, when I was writing this book, there were a couple of elements in this book that had they not, had I not had sort of these duh moments, like a Homer Simpson duh moment for myself, I think I would have looked back and went, I cannot believe I didn't, this book got published without me incorporating that in, where you just forget about some of these elements, right? But being a learning junkie to me is, it's awesome. Anything short of that, stale, boring, like, I don't know. I mean, there's just an opportunity to meet a lot of interesting people, no matter what you're doing, and level up. And that, if that makes me a learning junkie, then, you know, guilty as charged. It sounds like I'm speaking, though, to a colleague in the learning junkie ecosystem.
Over 2,000 interviews, well over it. And I mean, people operating at an insanely high level. You've interviewed people from Charles Barkley to the Pope. I mean, quite a diverse audience. And there's something that was bugging me the entire time I was reading through the guest list you've had.
Uh-oh.
I just keep thinking about it in my head. Because I asked this with, there's a guy who, I don't actually think it's been released yet, but he's a strength and conditioning coach. But he works with all types of athletes. Like you could be a golfer and he'll, I train you the exact same momentum that he has training UFC champion. And I asked him about what did he see, what trait did he find everybody at that level has. Like, there's their one trait, and he had a bucket full of them. And I want to ask you, because you've got a different perspective to the athlete side. So is there anything that you've noticed in all the people you've interviewed that they share?
Human need to just be seen. And that's different for everybody. And so one of the things, if someone says, okay, well, you've got to, I'm going to pin you down, Rod. You've got to tell me, like, what is one thing that you do well that has allowed you to get these types of interviews? I'd like to think, you know, reading sort of in my own, you know, the eulogy about me, it's that I took the time to ask the questions about their experience as humans, regardless of their level of accomplishment or notoriety publicly. And that was different. Like, I have a thing, ASG, I will tell people, like, when I get pitched stuff and they'll say, oh, will you interview so-and-so, right? Or, you know, we're our client, this and that. And I just tell them, I'm like, look, if it's in a press release, I'm not going to bring it up in the interview. Like, I'm not that guy. I'm just not going to do that. You can get that done all over the place with people that are younger than me, better than me, smarter, better looking, whatever. They can do that. That's not me. I want to find out about the A, the S, and the G in the name, to use sort of a loose example there, because to me, that's the stuff that people don't talk about. That's the, let's stop the elevator between two floors and let's look at what we're seeing above and what we're seeing below. That's, you know, what I think everybody shares. And I've, thank goodness, ASG, I have found that taking that approach, being crazy curious about the moments that are in the dark corners of somebody's mind, with being respectful, but understanding limits and sort of when you can go there, has allowed me to get people to share things where they'll say on camera or during the interview, never been asked that. It's like when I interviewed Habib, the Hall of Fame, the UFC Hall of Famer, I didn't focus on any of his fighting. And what did we talk about? We talked about how he shared with how he wanted to go back to Dagestan and sell vegetables like tomatoes to local villagers. And the feedback, it went viral on his channels. And I, silly me, I read comments because, you know, this day and age, that's dangerous. But I was really pleasantly surprised because his avid fans were like, we never knew this about him. In essence, it was kind of nice to take a break from just, how'd you beat McGregor here? Or how did you, you know, whatever. It was just about him as a human in that regard. So I think they all share that. And I try really hard to get that out of them. I've only had one instance that I can remember where I couldn't get it. There was this woman, incredibly professional. I appreciate her accomplishments as a CEO. She's done great, great work. One of the toughest interviews ever. Not because she didn't have a story to tell, it's because she didn't. She was on lockdown completely. And her publicist, her whole team knew about it. And I finally said to them, look, I've interviewed her a couple of times and I'm never doing it again. Because she is on book like nobody I have ever experienced in my life. Talking point, talking point, talking point. Like, she should run for office. I don't know how it'll go. She's a nice woman, but not a good interview. And I think those things are not, you know, they can be separate.
I think now, though, that's more common with, like, social media and the magical number of views. Because I was going back and forth talking to a guy, to get a content strategist out in Hollywood. I don't know if you've ever heard of the No Jumper podcast, but the guy on it, the host, he's like notoriously good at getting views. He's good at drumming up noise. And I asked this guy that I worked with him a few times, like, no, how does he do it? Because he just seems to have hit after hit. And he said he spends about 3 weeks before he has a guy on the show researching titles of clips that could go viral and using them as his questions. And when I go back now and watch those episodes, I can't not notice it. It's like he says the exact title in the episode and then he just runs off on a different question. And it's just, I think that like the thing you're talking about with this woman, I think that's more common now because they want the view and they end up, they don't really care. I don't really think I don't think they think the audience is caring about what they're saying.
And that's a fair point to some degree. I remember in the beginning, that was someone had to cancel a podcast or something. And I was doing it for a company. And this person was like, oh, bent out of shape. Oh, you know, what? And I said, you don't understand. It's the perception of the podcast. Like, if you really think that all the people that like it, like when you share on social media or that your family or friends listen to it, you're kidding yourself, right? If they're liking it, you know, there's a great percentage of them that will like your social post promoting it because they support you. That does not mean that they have the time and the day to basically download that. And or maybe they want a diversion away from the people they know, and they listen to podcasts of people that they'll never get to know, right? So that was, for me, important in the beginning. It's like, why worry about those sorts of things? Because I think if you're, but it's also, what is your objective, right? I wanted to get to be in the room with people that in the beginning, no one would have ever sort of picked up the phone or answered the email. And I did that because I focused on the content and I focused on giving something that hopefully was unique in that experience to where then they would recommend me to other people, or a publicist would say, oh my gosh, I got you in front of this person. Now I want to get you in front of another one. Because you can become their best friend too, right? I mean, that's what's interesting. If you're a good guest, other shows want to have you on. If you're a good host, other people want to be a guest on your show.
Your style of interview and like going for topics people necessarily don't expect whenever they're accepting to be interviewed by you, how do you prep for this? Because you interview people like UN leaders, you've had the Queen, like a royalty in Sweden and stuff. Do you go in to the prep of it blank, or do you have a game plan in the back of your head that you execute a different way?
About that sort of learning junkie. Like, what points of information in somebody's life do I need to be able to have a conversation that makes them feel as if I know them better than themselves? And so I approached it that way. And ever since then, like, now I'll get different out. Like, I'm interviewing coming up a documentary filmmaker, right? And so I watch the latest documentary. And so I'll spend that time to do it. But in general, I actually, less is more. Less is more, because I want to be able to react in the moment. Like, when I think back to clinical days in my old life in mental health, then how could I have a script, right? If you were coming in and I was doing a clinical intake on you, right, and you're there because either you want to be or you've been forced or court appointed, like, there are a million reasons you're going to come in that door presenting in a certain way. You're either going to see me as a friend or a foe. I don't have the chance to just sort of, I mean, yes, there are things I'd have to get from like information, just like if you go to your regular sort of doctor for your general health care. But you have to be able to pivot in the moment based on the stories that people share, right? Like why they're there. And so for me, I had to lean into that. The one thing that I did early on, and that I still tell people to this day, I should plant more trees, but like Xerox paper, just copy paper. I have a whole bunch here in front of me with my notes, just in general, my ideas. But back when I was learning about how to sort of stay in the moment, but also hit some key spots, I literally would divide a page up into four with my Sharpie. I love Sharpies and white blank copy paper. And I would, if I was interviewing you, I'd pick four areas of your life. Like if I challenged myself in 10 minutes, what can I learn about you? And write one word in the boxes, right? Now, if I'm done at the interview and I can tell that I can check off that I sort of ask questions within those domains, then I've done my job. And I wasn't forcing myself in any sort of particular order to ask those questions. So that's been my approach. I don't draw the line. I don't have the boxes anymore. But I think it's important that people are in the moment. It forces you to be in the moment and react, because you're going to have a better, more substantive response if you're living in the moment. It's like anything. You go on a first date, ASG. If you've got a script of what you're going to say, it's going to sound mechanical, right? If you can fly off the cuff and react to the person in front of you that you're trying, hopefully, to impress to some level, it's going to come across as much more genuine, and you give yourself a shot at creating a connection.
How did you go from dreaming about 60 minutes and like the hosting aspect of it to what you're doing now? You know, you're interviewing people from all over the world, going to refugee camps and stuff like that.
That's a great question. My wife would tell you that it's because I say yes to everything. I wish I could say that I had a grand plan. You know, years ago, I was collaborating with this technology company, and they were trying to find unique ways to get their message out because they were sort of the little engine that could. This is when podcasting was just starting. And I thought, you know, I'd done radio stuff. I'd done a bunch of little things here in media. And I just thought, I think I ought to just say to them, let's do a podcast. And I started to put that together. And naturally, I love strategy. I love chess. And I started to capture interviews of people. And then I would send that interview. I put that in the prose of an email to someone who was maybe at a higher level of their profession or whatever that strategic sort of level they had reached. And then they'd say, well, yes, I'll do an interview with you because you interviewed ASG and I kept leveling up in that way. And then I just had these, and because of that, it's a little bit of Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours. I just kept saying yes and working on improving my craft and utilizing what I had learned in getting my doctorate in clinical psych in my interviewing of people through the media and giving people different experiences. And so I think people who know me well go, oh, this makes perfect sense what Rod's doing. This is who he is. But if you told me to create a curriculum for young people, whether in Ireland or here, like, I don't know if I could do it or if anyone would want to sign up, because I put so much time and effort into being able to write with Forbes, entrepreneur, like all the, like those kind of components. I think of my life ASG as a bit of a portfolio. I don't mean from a financial sense, but that it's not linear, that all of these things are sort of related if I'm going to put together a meal. And so, yeah, sure, I have my podcasts and I collaborate with Fair Observer, an international publication, as an editor at large. And I have now my book, and I'm blessed that all of that has led to a TV development deal with the Jim Henson Company. People know them from The Muppets, on a show I developed. So all of those things, they kind of fit, but it's really because I've said yes. And this is just me. We talked about being a dreamer. I don't know about you, ASG, if you think like this, but like once I get into the candy shop of like opportunity, I get a little bit, not greedy, but it's like, okay, but what's next to the candy shop? What's in the back room? And you find out, whoa, you know, this is what happened. And I'm a huge believer in, I say yes, and I answer every email that I can, because you never know when it comes to circle back to you. I did a story in like 2017 on this refugee out of Kosovo who landed in Sweden. I do a story on him through a connection, a bit of a favor. He didn't know that. It goes viral in his old country. It goes on the front page of his newspapers. He leverages that and moves to Los Angeles. All this awesome stuff happens. And because of that, like hour I spent with him, I get connected to a publicist, and all of a sudden fast forward and I'm sitting with Magic Johnson doing an interview in Los Angeles, right? Like, it wouldn't have been that I had the objective to interview Magic Johnson. It was just that I had said originally yes to somebody who did have something interesting to say. I just didn't know the world that it would open up once I did that. So I'm a product of, it's a mix of luck. Hopefully like persistence, right? And maybe some level of annoyance to people, because I just keep kind of going, and I hope I don't ever lose that sort of dreamy state that I get in where I'm like, well, you know what? It's possible. It's totally possible.
So where can people find you? What have you got out at the moment? And what's coming in the future?
Well, thank you. My big push now, this is the shameless part. I'm not going to lie about it. I'm putting it out there. My book is The Narrative Edge, Authentic Storytelling That Meets the Moment. My publisher is Wiley. I would love it if folks take a look at it. You can pre-order it now. It'll hit your doorsteps in November. It's a book where I share myself, which ended up being a conscious choice in it. And I take you in any given chapter through to, you know, to my time with Pope Francis, to a refugee camp, to growing up, as a young boy with a dad who survived Nazi Germany. I take you all over the place. And I hope that it resonates with folks. And the early word on it is that it has, and I'm just so appreciative of that. So if people just go to my website, just drrodberger.com, you can go to wherever you order books. But that's I use that everywhere. So on Instagram, Dr. Rod Berger, same on LinkedIn. But I love to hear from folks. I am a guy that does do his very best to answer people when they reach out. So if you've got a question, I'd love to hear it. And you can also, I've got the Dr. Rod Berger channel for my podcast. I put them all under one umbrella as I'm being interviewed and as I've got three different shows. So that's kind of where you can find me.